deal with any obstacles, and complete our mission. Oh, and return safely. That was a priority. Ours was the most difficult and ill-defined of the tasks in the mission. We were facing defenses of unknown type and number, inside a structure we knew virtually nothing about, one in which Korbal himself might be lurking. I was going, of course. I had the megalith, which would be needed to transfer the handmaiden once we got into the Chamber of Ages. So was Eritas. I needed him to access the chamber, as well as get past the defenses he'd arranged to guard its secrets, and teach me to access the main vein of the Ghost Rock. I had no doubt he could take care of himself. He was a High Lord of the Alka Alon, with the stature and strength of a perfect human form. He combined the better elements of both our races in his present form. I would need additional warriors, I knew. Men as adept with spells as swords, as cunning as hunters as they were doughty as warriors. But I wanted to keep the number small. We needed to move fast, hit hard, and keep moving, if we were going to make the chamber. I selected Sire Kay to come, as he was both the most loyal and the most powerful warrior I knew. He'd already volunteered at Yule, swearing before Brigad that he would see the quest done. I would have liked to include Tyndall and Rondal, but I knew they would want to be near their sovereign on the mission, and to be honest, I wanted them there. The last thing I needed was to get a sitting duke killed on one of my foolish wizard's quests. Another one, that is. I chose Onrenyon because he was useful, if annoying, and he was soaked in the lore of the Alka Alon. He suggested bringing Master Asguri, his comrade and friend, because having both a Karshak and a Master Stone Singer along wouldn't hurt, and he could carry a lot of things, even at his age, the old Songmaster grinned. He challenged me to see just how many things I could convince the Karshak to carry. The bastard. Lelastian insisted on coming, simply for the chance to see the Ghost Rock in person, herself, and I almost said no. But she was the best healer in the world, better than Master Ikarod, and her experience had given her some unique insights on both Alkan and human culture. She was also familiar with the Vundle, which might be helpful. We might have to protect her, but she was pretty wily, and no one on the Alkan Council would complain if she died along the way. When it was starting to look like I had more brains than brawn, I decided to include a couple of fellows I knew I could rely on in a fight. Sandoval, who had been recently rejected as Castali Ducal Court Wizard in favor of a friend of Moran's, was between jobs. Not only was he a good combat mage, he was also another thaumaturge. Not as good as Taran, but good. Given some special armor and weaponry from Sevendor's vaults, he could be quite formidable. More important, he was trustworthy. I considered Lorcus, but I discovered that my vassal war mage had already taken a commission for Draenors. He was consulting on the conquest of Moros. Apparently, Draenors had been taken with how quickly and easily he'd prosecuted his war against Rallone, and wanted to benefit from his unique advice. I couldn't blame him, but this wasn't the kind of mission Lorcus was best suited for. This was an infiltration, true, but I needed someone sneaky, not unpredictable. Likewise, Lance of Boon was out. He was busy working on a special royal commission for the next several months. I couldn't take a man away from paying work. That would be unprofessional. I figured that if Azar would be involved in the Gatebreakers, then he'd recruit Wenek and Astaroth out of a sense of competitive loyalty. The same with Telamon. His strength was commanding men in battle, not plunging into the depths of a cavern. He needed to be directing the battle for the waypoints, not hiding his talents in shadow. Instead, I chose Mavon. He was Dar for a Gilmoran, but he was serious about his work, and not as flamboyant as some other war magi I could name. He had a head for high politics, and he was as good in combat as most war magi. I could trust him. He'd been looking after the Order's interests in various ways while tending to his own domain in southeastern Gilmora, chosen as his reward, like I had selected Sevendor. But he was a war mage first, a mage lord second. He was always ready to assist with little missions and such, and this was just too juicy a quest to pass up. When I asked him, he said he felt honored. I debated long and hard before including another, but if one is going sneaking into darkness, then having a shadow mage along is not a bad idea. I happened to have the acquaintance of one, Lord Hans. The Master Thief was reluctant to go when I made the offer, mind to mind, until he discovered that Duke Anguin was going to be on the expedition personally. Then he insisted on coming, and volunteered his talented family to help with the effort as well. In particular, he insisted that his son Utterpol accompany His Grace. That would be a sufficient party, I figured, to get us through Korbal Citadel and down into the Undercaverns, I hoped. The truth was, I had no idea what would be needed, or whose talents would be of most use on the expedition. I chose as wisely as I could from among the many talented people I knew, and that was the best I could do. It would have to work. I tried my best to let the other team leaders choose their members without interference. Indeed, I tried to avoid them entirely, lest I get a reputation for standing over their shoulder. Anguin would choose who he would, but with Tyndall, Rundle, and Utterpol along, I tried not to worry about him. His success or failure would be his own. I was just using him for the distraction. The same went for Pentandra and Terlaman and their teams. Terlaman knows violence like a bride knows kisses, and Pentandra understood organization and planning at a spiritual level. I had every confidence in their ability to choose their members without my advice. Tarrant did, indeed, have a plan to deal with the Wyverns, and a number of other things. Now that Master Ulin was not preoccupied with the centerpoint problem, Tarrant monopolized the enchanter's time and most of the advanced enchantments in my private workshop to prepare his armament. I left him alone, too. That didn't mean I didn't work on my own weapons and armor. With the new power of the megalith, I went back over my combat gear and improved it as much as I could. I did the same with Twilight, my mage blade, and Blizzard, my warstaff. I attached new hocksters to my weapons harness, filling them with things I thought might be useful, and a bunch of things I knew probably wouldn't be useful, but I added them anyway. One of the things I practiced while I prepared was using the megalith itself as a weapon. The mage-hardened gold harness it sat within was pretty, but hardly lethal on its own. The incredible power bound inside the globe needed to be focused and directed before it could be purposefully lethal. I tinkered with the thing for 3 days, coming up with methods to make the megalith a potent weapon, not just a floating bauble. That turned out to be easier than I suspected, once Onranyan got involved. He found a unique stone that could be used to filter and direct the arcane power of the sphere. With a little fiddling, we were able to get it to emit 5 kinds of usefully destructive energy. I arranged for new hocksters containing my blade, my various staves, and other items I used frequently, anchored in the stones around the base of the megalith, the portion enclosing the knot coral that kept it suspended in the air. Keeping them in rings was handy, but rings could get lost. Just to ensure that none of my precious items could, even if the sphere was stolen, I anchored the hocksters to something in my tower. I'm paranoid like that. A man can only do so much preparation before he realizes that he's killing time. The weather was warming, and the entire domain was beginning the all-important rituals of the agricultural calendar. Tallies of those who died during the winter, and those babes who survived, were gathered by the priests of Huin as they hurried from field to field, blessing the land and using the agricultural wands to plow and furrow the soil. The foundations for a new shrine to the Visitation of the Seven was being dug on the commons. A new crop of squires showed up for training at the castle, and household knights left for their own lands, as they were replaced by those whose turn at the duty it was. I saw the first caravan of the Arcane Mercantile Guild set forth from Sevendor to Castabriel with a load of werewood, freshly harvested from our own forest, and particularly potent for saplings, snowstone, 3 cartloads of enchantments, and a cart full of everything from Sevendor glass to sympathy stones from Trestendor's mines. I spent a lot of time with my family, who were extending their goodbyes as long as they could. Mama was using the spring floods as an excuse as they began to swell the rivers that would take them home. I think I ate dinner at their hall every other night, while they were still there. Seeing my kids around their grandparents was worth a sphere of gold from my collection. No question. Yet it all seemed empty and incomplete without Alia's presence. She left a hole in my life larger than the hole in the countryside left by my missing mountain. The kids missed her and were confused about where exactly she'd gone. I missed her, desperately. She was who kept me from doing anything truly stupid, like planning a suicidal expedition into the very chambers of our darkest enemies for no better reason than to save my wife. She would have been dead set against me doing that. We had one final grand strategy meeting at Carmela's Tower before we began the final preparations for the Enterprise. Despite my impatience, I had to admit that a lot had gotten accomplished. Pentandra had not only organized the support team, she had prepared a familiar place for them to reside, the Blue Barn at Timberwatch. The former battlefield was already swarming with Magi, thanks to Tyndall and Rondor's recruitment effort for the Astasi Order, and there were another couple of thousand Wilderlords and assorted mercenaries wandering around. It was about as secure a location as we could ask for, and the Blue Barn wasn't being used for anything but storage at that point. We still didn't know what the team would need, but Timberwatch was as good a staging area as any. For their part, the Astasi Order had a very successful recruitment drive. The boys did me the courtesy of dropping by the tower a few days before the official meeting and showing off their results. They swaggered in, dressed like rich Wilderlords, and plopped down on stools in my workshop, just like the old days. "We've just returned from a highly productive training and assessment," Rondal began, producing a scroll from a huckster. 196 war magi and other interested parties appealed for consideration to the Order. After we spent hundreds of stags on minstrels and jongleurs to talk about how God's damn wonderful we are, Tyndall added, to Rondal's annoyance. We assessed them on the basis of talent, training, martial skill, and war magic. A number of familiar faces appeared, interested in joining our illustrious and storied in the songs and tales of dozens of expensive jongleurs and minstrels, Tyndall interrupted, and noble errant order of the Astasi Knights Magi. Rondal finished firmly. We established a series of trials, based loosely on the rites of Duin, to establish which among them was the strongest in each category. The cumulative scores were used to rate them best to worst, with a number of special notes of interest, he added with a slight smile. We were liberal in our consideration for admission, Tyndall grumbled. We wanted to ensure we got the widest possible pool of talent, Rondal corrected, and I think we profited by that. Among the notables are some familiar names and former students. Icars, Hanalif, and Busselin all appeared for consideration, as did Caswellan. They all scored in the top 30, he added proudly. They were high magi, Tyndall dismissed. They had an advantage. Our top competitors were Caswellan, the Fox, Golvod of Temaria, Gerendrin, who styles himself the Grim these days. Oh, and plenty more. It's a real holiday parade of magical killers, Rondal continued. Again, witch stones, Tyndall shrugged. Some other intriguing competitors were Darrow of Quinns, that Rumeran who won the Spellmonger's trial a few years back. He ranked at 56. Coradine the Unkillable was our top-rated lady at 16. The top-rated sport came in at number 18, a Castali knight named Sir Jessin. What can he do? I asked curiously. He doesn't get tired, Tyndall offered. Ever. We put everyone through grueling endurance tests. 10 hours carrying rocks back and forth. It really brought out everyone's cheery side. The first 5 hours were done without magical assistance. The second 5 hours it was allowed. At the end of the day, Sir Jessin was still moving them back and forth as fast and efficiently as he had at the beginning of the day. He doesn't get tired. Handy, I chuckled. And everyone is prepared to go on a secret mission? We didn't use your name, but they assumed it was for you. Either that, or Anguin was going to invade an Ultramar with just us, which is laughable. But we let it be known to the men we trusted that the best war magi would be working with you, and that knighthoods would accompany the successful completion of the mission, Tyndall added. We also let it slip that there would be employment for everyone who completed the trials who wanted it, whether they made the cut or not. Rondal agreed. Anguin is keen to see his enslaved subjects liberated before he goes. How is he faring as team leader? He wisely deferred most of the decision-making to Rondal, Tyndall said sourly. I am the better Thaumaturge, Rondal pointed out without malice. We need to get into that tower, and that's going to be tricky. That's why he put me in charge of that. Otherwise, I'm just another spark on the squad. Well, there's going to be an addition to your squad. Utterpon. Mage Lord Hans has all but insisted he accompany his grace to watch his back. A shadow mage should be good for that.
Hey, I thought that was our job, and Gideon's,
Tyndall protested. We watch his front, Rondell instructed his colleague.
Gideon? He's taking his bodyguard.
Unacknowledged bastard half-brother, actually, Rondell supplied. One of Lengwin's follies from his youth, raised in Castol. Professional jouster. Pentandra dug him up. Not as smart or educated as Angwin, but a good man, he appraised. And he can do more than joust, Tyndall added. He's fought with the Third Commander all winter, rooting out outposts and listening posts around Verone. The man can use a cavalry blade, he agreed.
Good.
I want Angwin's ducal arse protected. In many ways, he has the easiest job, but he's also got one of the more dangerous ones. If he falls into Corbel's hands.
Master, that just isn't going to happen,
Rondell declared defiantly.
We'd die before we'd let Angwin be taken,
Tyndall affirmed resolutely.
He laughs at my jokes. That's hard to find in a boss.
My opinion of him just declined, I winced. Tyndall's sense of humour was a little off. But I'm glad we understand each other. If it's a choice between Angwin's life and Radin's rescue, you preserve the Duke and abandon the Princess. We can always make another attempt, but we only have one Duke of Alshar.
We shall do our best, Master,
Rondell affirmed. Beyond that, Radin and the Dradrian Smith are your highest priorities. As soon as you have them, you get all three of them out of there as fast as you can. If all goes well, those war magi you selected will be spreading out across the city, seeding mayhem and destruction among our foes while you're rescuing the princess.
I can't believe they get to have all the fun,
griped Tyndall. It would be more of an honour if the spiteful sovereign, Rondell said, choosing his words carefully, would act more like a princess and less like the head of the Brotherhood of the Rat.
Sure, she's a vindictive and spiteful killer, I agreed, but she's the princess that needs rescuing.
You don't have to marry her afterwards, I pointed out.
No one will, Rondell said, shaking his head sadly.
Not after she's been held hostage.
She wasn't exactly flooded with suitors before she was kidnapped, snorted Tyndall.
Regardless, the honour of this rescue belongs to Angwin. You're just helping, like good gentlemen of the court.
For which we will no doubt be rewarded by anyone who doesn't know Radin personally,
Tyndall agreed.
It's not for the reward. It's for the glory of the Astasi Order, I reminded him.
Look, it was your idea to found an order of magical knights errant. Don't think I'm not going to use it when I need to.
I knew that would bite us in the arse someday,
Rondell muttered. We talked a little more shop, mostly about some of the innovative ideas Taran had about eliminating the Wyvern threat. Then we got on the topic of general mayhem, and Rondell had a couple of suggestions I liked. He and Tin had a lot of experience in general mayhem last summer, and they had arrived at some delightful solutions to the problem. I gave them permission to develop a few particular spells I liked the sound of, and sent them on their way to the Enchanter's Sheds, after they stopped at the Rat Trap and got some much-needed sleep. I studied the scroll of names and the notations they'd made on everyone, and I singled out a few for special attention in the future. I also drew up a list of who I thought should go in each of the two halves of the Gatebreakers, and who should be helping out the support team. It was a good list. The boys had done well, and had certainly put the war magi through their paces. I had no doubt that once they were in combat, they would bring destruction and chaos to our enemies. You just couldn't ask for more than that. When I spoke of it to Pentandra later that day, she was full of praise for their efforts. Not only had they assembled the cream of the war magi in Alshar, they managed to introduce almost 2,000 mundane warriors to the idiosyncrasies of working with them. The men had gone to Timberwatch as seasoned Wilderlands warriors. They returned, understanding the great advantages that the magical corps could bestow on an infantry or cavalry unit. They'd even learned to use simple magical items designed to be activated by anyone, as well as use a map, understand a mage map, appreciate the value of wards and scrying in the field, all that sort of thing. With the help of the Alshari Third Commando, an entire company skilled at the more mundane sorts of battlefield specialties, they made a formidable backbone to the coming emancipation effort. Finally, the day came when we met one last time at Angwin's Tower to prepare for the mission. Each team leader made a full report,
and I made certain that my entire team, the smallest of the four, was included in the discussion. The news was mostly good. The initial campaign to liberate the human slaves in the Penumbra was set. "We've established caches of food along the likely routes of retreat," Pentandra reported, glancing over a scroll on the elegant wooden table. Rummel's folk did exquisite work. "We're also going to post pickets, companies of 20 heavily armed warriors, to guard the slaves as they march. They won't be enough to halt a determined pursuit against a large force, but they could slow it down in time for reinforcements to arrive. Any skirmishers should be easily dealt with. Most of the effort will be focused on 11 strongholds across the length of the Wilderlands. Most of the slaves will be safe when they're beyond the Whitewater or below the Tinial. We've prepared encampments on the other bank and have patrols screening the fords. Every iron-band castle is open to them. We've gotten assurances from local lords that they won't be turned away. As many as possible will be taken to the northeast, around the marble quarry or the anvil. If we can get them there, we can keep them safe." "Most of us will be assisting in the effort," Astaroth agreed, smiling broadly. "I've prepared Tudri against any eventuality, and that includes a sudden influx of penniless refugees. There are still plenty of empty houses down in Newtown, and the local estates need labor. I've purchased from friendly merchants," he said, glancing at me knowingly, "a significant quantity of grain, salt pork, peas, and other foodstuffs, as well as some healing ointments and bandages. I've got every temple in the town preparing for wounded, and the garrison ready for reprisals." Count Salgo filled us in on the tactical situation, looking every bit the warlord of Castal in richly burnished plate armor, with a baldric with his gold badge of office on his shoulder. He strutted around like a man 20 years younger. Apparently the heir in Verone agreed with him. "The vanguard of the attack will be small units of rangers and war magi who will infiltrate the areas surrounding the camps an hour before dawn. They will infest each area with traps, snares, and magical challenges, then fall back and lure the enemy's main forces out with a series of timed distractions along the perimeter just as the sun breaks. Each new distraction will be designed to bring their main forces farther and farther away from their camps. Then cavalry forces will approach each encampment shielded by war magic. At a prearranged time, they will strike hard, doing their best to lure the secondary defenders out into the trap zone and thence to slaughter. At that time, the rangers and advanced war magi will liberate the prisoners and lead them out, behind the screen of the cavalry. Once the camps are emptied, the cavalry will act as rearguard to quell any pursuit. Small companies of infantry will be posted to accompany the liberated slaves for the first 10 miles, before a designated rest. We should have food, water, and some emergency aid available. The resting period should be no longer than 4 hours before pressing them on another 10 miles. That gives the cavalry time to respond, to distract or mislead the pursuers before they get organized."
"Oh, we plan on doing more than that,"
Azar grinned unpleasantly. "The Megalini have worked to perfect certain spells that will, we hope, convince the various units of treachery and deceit from each other. They've started using simple codes in their written orders, and we had no trouble breaking them. I think they can be used to convince some of them to attack their fellows, given sufficient provocation." "When the slaves get to the third resting point, about midnight, that's when the war magi will begin an active defense," he said, nodding toward Azar.
"Our plan is to leave most of our mundane forces to guarding and escort, and gather war magi in strength, then strike at the largest concentrations of pursuers as aggressively as possible."
"When he says aggressively, he means leaving no bone unburned," Wenek chuckled.
"The goal is to devastate the foe with magic, without risk of civilian casualties," Azar reported. "Our enemy will be concentrating to give chase to their escaped property. Once our scouts and scryers identify where the enemy is, we take them while they are on the march, weary after a long day's scrambling, and complacent. We shall take advantage of their eagerness to regain their slaves against a few horsemen by demonstrating what a high mage can do in his wrath, and we continue the effort all night until they give up chasing or the dawn comes."
"And what happens if they persist when dawn comes?" asked Sandoval.
"If any survive the cool night for the blinding of the sun, they will chance to cross a thickly enchanted series of enchantments and hidden redoubts, which will conceal snipers, irritant magi,
and command those ready to pounce. If they survive until noon, then the regrouped cavalry will charge in the full light of the sun while the slaves continue toward their sanctuaries.
And if they persist past noon,
prompted Telamon, then we invite them to luncheon,
snorted Azar.
If they are that far away from their strongholds, their reinforcements, and their foul lords, then pressing pursuit in the face of such odds will slay them before they again see dusk, he said, with an air of finality.
We hope to convince them to quit pursuit long before, answered Salgo, but should they linger, we should have sufficient forces at hand to gather and give battle. I've studied the disposition reports carefully, however, and I think this unlikely.
Duin alone knows, agreed Pentandra. The key is to get them so riled and angry that Chirul begins moving his armies into a defensive position, away from being able to support Korbal in the south, if asked.
How long do you think that should take?
3-4 days at the most, Salgo replied. That could be off by as much as 3 days.
And if they don't move their troops into a defensive position?
Then we'll turn around and ride back through them, Salgo suggested. If they are going to leave their heartland undefended, it would be remiss of us not to attack it.
But not all of Alshar, Pentandra corrected. Those involved in the Olam Saheri mission will quit the battle as soon as it is assured, and meet back at Timberwatch to prepare for the assault. His grace and his war magi will be widely reported to the Gavani chain of command, and enough will be left behind to convince them that there are still many in the field. Then those gathered at Timberwatch will begin their mission. Telamon?
We begin our assault with a 10-man squadron entering the northern waypoint as a vanguard. Their job is to eliminate any immediate defenders and hold the spot. The second squadron will appear 3 minutes later and start to disperse. When it becomes apparent that the alarm has been raised and reinforcements are on the way, the second team's first squadron will enter the eastern waypoint. They will both continue to receive reinforcements in 3-minute waves. 1/4 of the squadrons will hold the waypoint and defend it. The rest will fan out across the island, causing as much damage as possible.
What about the bloody wyverns? Asked an annoyed voice from the back.
I'll take care of them, Taran assured. I will be in the first wave, and will launch my spells at the outset of the battle. By the time the third wave shows up, I doubt there will be a wyvern over the island, he said smugly.
And the dragons? The same voice asked.
Let us hope it doesn't come to that, Taran answered, but if it does, it will be an ideal time to experiment in the field.
Once the wyverns are dealt with, Dara said, stepping forward boldly, 3 wings of Skyriders will start patrolling over the island to keep an eye for dragons, and assist the Magi wherever they can.
Can your giant hawks win against a dragon?
We don't know, Dara confessed,
but the last time I was there, I dropped a 40-ton boulder on a dragon's head. It's brain damaged now. The Skyriders are not to be trifled with, she said indignantly. She seemed to be faring better now, as the weeks went by and her duties distracted her about her lost friendship with Gareth. It helped that Frightful's eggs had hatched. 2 new giant hawks, Fancy and Fluster, were greedily devouring whatever goat or rabbit their proud mother brought them in the Muse Tower. Since the hatching, Dara's mood had changed, and she'd taken on a more serious, if less dire, demeanor. By the time the last of the gate breakers entered the fray, Telamon continued, it will be time for the West Wardens to begin their assault.
Your Grace?
I will defer to my gentleman, Sir Rondal, Duke Angwin said, nodding to my former apprentice.
The West Wardens will enter the island through the third hidden waypoint, he explained, after clearing his throat. Once we are secure, we will launch our attack from a distance on the ground level of the tower. As soon as the troops above respond, we will secure entry to the upper levels.
How? Giant hawk?
As much fun as that would be, we don't want to risk our fierce, feathered friends getting shot during the attempt. We have 2 or 3 different ways to get into the top of the tower, including a master thief.
Journeyman thief, corrected Hans.
A really good thief, Rondal continued with a grin, and a couple of sophisticated magic spells. We didn't want to get all that way and not have some options.
Once we have someone inside, we can transport the rest of our party into the cell level. There we liberate the prisoners, beat back any resistance, and exit the battle as expediently as possible as soon as we have them.
Simple, he shrugged casually.
Simple? Compared to what?
scoffed someone else. Slaying a dragon, destroying a complex criminal enterprise over summer holiday, facing down a powerful undead and living to tell the tale. You know, the usual. It would have sounded like a brag from anyone else, but Rondal spoke with the confidence of a man who had been put in impossible situations over and over and was used to them. "Which brings us to my team," I said, clearing my throat. "The scholars will enter the fray just after the Westwardens. We will provide what support we can, as long as we can, but at the first convenient moment we will break for the Citadel of Korbal, over the entrance to the Undercaverns. I'm assuming there will be sentries to deal with. We will deal with them and gain entry." "And then what?" someone asked, when I stalled. I sighed. "Then, I have no idea. We'll have to improvise the entire way."
"What? The spellmonger has no plan," chuckled Azar.
"You cannot plan for what you do not know to anticipate," I said thoughtfully. "I'll just do what I usually do, make it up as I go along."
Chapter 25 Complaints and Recriminations. I met with the scholars privately under a tree in the courtyard after the larger session to discuss the details of our unplannable mission. Saake the Dragon Slayer, Lord Hans the Shadow Sired, Lord Eritas, the Sorceress of Sartha Wood, Onranyun the Reprobate, Master Ashguri the Stone Singer, Mage Lords Sandoval and Mavone, and me. 9 of us who would take the plunge into darkness. They were some of the best and most talented people of the age, and I was about to get them all killed. We discussed the equipment needed. Lord Eritas briefed us on what to expect after we entered the tunnel to the Undercaverns, and then we speculated on what we would face in Korbal's fortress. Palace? Workshop? Crypt?
"Undead," Mavone suggested. "Lots and lots of undead. Dragon, Nemavorti, perhaps even some of the regular kind, just for variety.
Oh, and the necromancer himself. I may have some remedy for them, but we won't know until we encounter them. I've been studying basic necromancy."
"I propose hitting them," Saake suggested, "really, really hard."
"That's why I'm bringing you," I agreed. "But if anyone else has any secret spells or ancient weapons that can kill undead, now is the time to dust them off."
"Wasn't it said that Korbal is using a human body?" the Lastian asked, curious.
"So it seems. The biggest human body he could find, apparently, from what Tyndall reported. But it was decomposing rapidly, so he may well have switched to a sturdier form by now."
"Pantandra indicated that she'd had some success against the Nemavorti," Mavone offered. "Stabbing them in the head does work, as does decapitation, and vital energy disrupts their necromantic architecture, it seems. One would assume that Korbal is as vulnerable to such arguments as his minions."
"When we strove against the Enshadowed in the Elder Days," Lord Eritas offered, "they would occasionally use undead if they had no better soldiery. We found them more of an annoyance than a danger, but they do have weaknesses."
"Such as?"
"Cold," he offered. "Undead do not produce heat of their own, for their metabolism is engaged by dark forces, not the vital energy of life. When song spells of freezing are applied, they are particularly effective, for reducing the temperature of the ichor within the abominations impedes their motion. Then you cut their heads off," he added.
"A timely explanation," I nodded. "Freezing spells were easy, especially with the throbbing globe of power that haunted my every step now. Anyone else?"
"Necromantic energy is immune to many effective counters to regular thaumaturgic practice," Sandoval observed, thoughtfully.
"We found that out the hard way in Faris," he said, rolling his eyes at the memory.
"But there are ways to disrupt it. Creating a standing wave field in a disharmonious vibration could cause a necromantic system to fail, even damage the underlying architecture. If it was dependent..."
"Let's skip the thaumaturgic lecture," I said, as I watched Sayake's eyes glaze over.
"Wrong crowd."
"Right," he agreed, shaking off the urge to think out loud.
"I have some things I can do," he answered simply.
"That's what I want to hear," I nodded.
"Do them."
My old comrade from the Farisian campaign nodded. We continued to discuss the details of the mission, from how we'd gain entry to the Citadel to how we'd seal the Chamber of Ages and escape, until the late afternoon.
When we'd talked out everything we could, we agreed to prepare ourselves and await the hour of our departure. Most of us were going to fight in the Emancipation Campaign. Mavone and Sandoval insisted, and Sayake felt honor-bound to participate on the basis of recovering his fellow Wilderlands folk. I decided at the last minute I wanted to be involved too. I'd seen what happened to human slaves in the Penumbra. Now that the dead god wasn't dependent on human sacrifice to grow the Umbra anymore, the lives of those slaves had just declined in value. If they weren't rescued now, they'd never live to see sacrifice. They could be beaten and slain with impunity. I couldn't see that happen. I had to help stop it and recover as many as I could. As much as my quest to restore Alia was important to me, I still had a duty to secure those who were taken from the Wilderlands and Gilmora and forced into the grisly mill of the Dead God's Empire. Otherwise, it wouldn't matter if I had Alia back or not. Those were her countrymen in part, and perhaps her very neighbors. If I'd brave the undercaverns of the Necromancer for her, I had to also try to rescue as many of her folk as I could. In case you hadn't realized it yet, life as the spellmonger is morally complicated. I checked in with Turleman after my meeting adjourned. He and Salgo were going over details of the planned offensive, and both welcomed my participation in the effort. "I think we can use you best at Fethkala," Salgo said thoughtfully. "Never heard of it," I confessed. "You wouldn't, unless you speak Gavanni," the warlord chuckled. "It's a novelty of sorts, a homemade Gavanni castle. It's built in our style, in a fashion, and it sits atop an underground complex overlooking three once prosperous farmholds. Now it's a slave plantation growing barley and oats, as well as other foodstuffs and supplies. Over 10,000 human slaves," he informed me. "Mostly Gilmorans, but plenty of Wilderfolk too. It's fascinating because it's the farthest eastern vassal of the so-called Goblin King," Turleman grinned. "It's run in traditional feudal style by Lord Sir Felet, a Gervan warlord of great repute, in the Gavanni Royal Court at Gans, which used to be a third-rate castle in the hinterlands," he laughed. "So, striking this place will be a message to the goblins. You broke the truce last summer, then reprised with a dragon attack," Salgo stated flatly. "The truce is over, and we will strike you at will." "How many defenders?" I asked, not caring much for the politics of the matter. I just wanted to hit some things to warm up. "Lord Sir Felet commands a garrison of 600 hobgoblin heavy infantry, 300 Gavanni light infantry and archers, another 300 Gavanni overseers, and a cavalry force of 50 human confederates," Salgo reported. "Less than 1,500 hold more than 10,000 hostage. How many on our side?" "I'll be sending you in with your two gentlemen scholars," Turleman decided, "in addition to a half-dozen war magi contending to be in the gatebreakers. I'd like your assessment of their abilities in combat, if you'd be so kind. But then you'll have 700 Wilderlord cavalry, led by Count Markadine, assisting you in the task." "Markadine? That will be a pleasure," I agreed. "Could you include Sayake in his party? The Dragon Slayer has a serious case of itchy spurs, and riding with the highest-ranking Wilderlord in the land before embarking on a desperate mission would calm his jitters," I suggested. "I think that can be arranged," Count Salgo nodded. "We've nurtured His Excellency's whims for political purposes, and he holds the Dragon Slayer in high esteem." "My thanks. A couple of days in the field before the mission would be pleasant," I decided. "I've not had a fight since Yule, and Sire Kay did most of the work." "It's important to stretch before a workout," Turleman agreed solemnly. "To Fethkala, then," I nodded. "Let's introduce His Furry Majesty's gentle Gervan to the spellmonger and see if he enjoys the experience as much as my own liege lords do." As I was crossing the courtyard to say my goodbyes to Pentandra, I ran into a tearful apprentice. Dara was wiping her eyes and pulling her hawking cloak protectively around her. "What's wrong?" I asked, frowning. "Nobody will bloody tell me anything about Garrett," she spat. "No one. I've asked everyone, and either they say they haven't seen him, or they won't say anything about him at all. The most I've heard is that he's changed his name," she said dejectedly. "That's it. Garrett isn't Garrett anymore, and no one knows what he's calling himself now." I didn't know what to say, so I let her keep talking. Ishi's tits, there was no way I could stop her.
It's not like I stabbed the boy or anything, she said, wiping her eyes in disgust. I just told him I didn't bear him the affection he wanted, and for that he has to change his name and leave the country.
He was clearly very affected by your answer, I said, as hesitantly as possible. I had five sisters. There are times, I had learned, when saying as little as possible was the wisest course of action.
So why is everyone covering up his escape? Am I so awful? Tyndall and Rhonda look amused. That haystack laughed. They are the ones who told me he changed his name. He may even have changed his appearance.
Did they say anything else? Just that I shouldn't expect to see him in Sevendor any time soon, or ever, or anywhere, she sputtered.
They say he's gone and won't be coming back. Over me, she said, sobbing. I promised Bannermore that I'd try to find him and talk him into coming back, she said,
pulling her hair out of her face. I've been so busy with Frightful's hatching that I haven't had much time, and then getting ready for this mission. But I figure that someone here would have heard something, but no one who knows anything will say anything, and most people haven't heard anything.
It's maddening, she supplied.
Her teary eyes squinched together under her unruly red hair.
All I want to do is talk to him.
What would you say? I asked. Innocent question.
What would I say?
She asked in disbelief.
What would I say? Let's start with telling him that he's foolish for sulking off like that, just because I don't want to... I deeply value his friendship and deeply care for his welfare. That should be sufficient cause to value mine. If he cares for me, as he claims, then I wish him to see the distress he's caused me by his sudden departure. Had he but bidden, I could have explained to him that...
She broke off, stumbling for words. Perhaps you should consider just what you wish to say before you attempt to locate him, I suggested gently. It might undermine the sincerity of your feeling if you weren't able to explain what that feeling is.
I know exactly what I wish to say to him,
she declared indignantly.
When I see his face, whatever name he chooses, I will speak my mind.
And just what is that mind saying, Dara? I asked gently. I was getting frustrated with this matter. Indeed, it is not your mind to which Gareth appealed. It was your heart.
My heart is my own to keep, she insisted.
And to give, I added. He made a bid for yours. You rejected that bid.
I am a professional woman, she declared. I can't entertain such matters while I'm apprenticed.
Dara, you're nearing the end of your apprenticeship, I informed her, and I am not amiss to my apprentices having romantic lives. Just that they keep them from interfering with their duties and studies. You cannot cling to that excuse much longer.
But it's the best one I have,
she admitted, as frustrated as I was.
I like Gareth, but to give him my heart? She asked doubtfully.
Are there any others who would wish to bid for it? I asked casually.
That's none of your business, she said hotly, or Gareth's.
Indeed, I agreed sagely, and so you told him apparently. As it is none of his business or mine, he chose to act on that intelligence, I said reasonably.
Take action? He bloody vanished, she exclaimed.
So he did, I agreed, as we began to walk slowly toward Pentandra. You're a good wizard. Why did he do that?
He's hurt,
Dara admitted, a lot.
He's angry, and he's embarrassed.
Those are good speculations. I agreed. When you are hurt, angry, and embarrassed, what do, Dara?
Me? I just go up to the Muse Tower and sit with my burden till I overcome it, she explained. Frightful is a good listener. I used to use the cottage in the Nutwood, she recalled. But when you have your own tower?
But you withdraw. You go talk to someone. Why deny the man the same?
Because he doesn't know everything yet,
Dara exploded.
He doesn't. He didn't really talk to me. He just asked one dumb question and then threw his whole life away when he didn't like the answer.
Has your answer changed? I asked, curious.
No,
she assured.
He's a friend, but my heart does not lead me to him.
Then I doubt much else you have to say will alter his opinion, I'm afraid. I sighed.
If I just had a chance to talk to him, to convince him, she said, shaking her head. Everyone knows that I'm the reason he's gone. My brothers are making jokes about it. I thought Rhondahl and Tyndall would be helpful, since they're his friends, but they... They shut me out. Completely. They wouldn't tell me anything. And they joked about it, too, like I broke his heart or something.
Think about that, Dara, I said gently. I'll speak to the boys and try to focus on the mission now. We need you and your Skyriders here and in the battle, not looking in vain for wizards who aren't there. She nodded, blew her nose, and shuffled away, thanking me for my help. I had no idea if I'd helped, but I immediately contacted Tyndall mind to mind. What in three hells did you say to Dara? I demanded.
What? Oh, she was asking about Gareth the Ghost. We didn't tell her anything, he promised.
What you didn't tell her was enough to set her to tears, I reproved. We're on the eve of one of the biggest missions in our lives, and she's commanding the skies overhead. Why did you want to rile her like that?
Master, we didn't. I promise, Tyndall pleaded. She came to us, riled, demanding this and insisting that. Gareth swore us to secrecy, he explained. We can't break his confidence, especially to Dara. She was explicitly mentioned.
I understand, I said patiently, but laughing in her face? That was just cruel.
So was what she did to Gareth,
Tyndall replied defensively.
Even Natia thinks so, and she was there. Look, I like Cephas, I do, but he has her eye without even trying. Gareth overthrew the bloody Brotherhood and went toe-to-toe with an Emmervort. Hells, he's already been to Olam Saheri, and she doesn't bat an eyelash.
So you're the ones who put him up to confronting her with his feelings.
If he hadn't,
would she have ever pressed the matter? He challenged. Probably not, but that's not for you to say, I replied.
Isn't it?
Tyndall asked.
A mate came to me with a problem. I tried to help him out.
His problem is my apprentice, I reminded him,
which means you have a problem too.
I don't have a problem, he added, a bit arrogantly. That puts me in a good position to give advice on other people's problems. So, what is your advice to me on this problem?
You? Oh, I'd probably tell you to leave her alone and let her suffer. She made her choice. She has to contend with the consequences.
That might be satisfying, but it's not particularly effective, I chided.
Effective? She's not going to feel right until she has Gareth in her pouch where she wants him, outside of her skirts, not something intimate. I like Dara, Master, but if she's not going to love the man, she needs to turn him loose for someone else to.
He sounded indignant on Gareth's behalf. I don't disagree, I sighed evenly, but this isn't the best time for one of my commanders to be emotionally compromised.
Take it up with Ishii,
Tyndall recommended. Don't think I won't. Just try to keep the torment to a minimum, will you?
I'll endeavour to be more professional, Master, he agreed, with far too much deference.
I sighed to myself after I broke the connection. No doubt I had more tears in my future. Pentandra looked up and seemed positively pleased to see me, as she handed a sheaf of parchment to her blind apprentice and sent her on her way.
I was wondering if you were going to chat, she smiled. I think that went well.
We're getting better at it, I conceded, but I'm expecting 100 different things to go horribly wrong, I added.
I think we all are, honestly, she said, nodding thoughtfully. I was discussing it with Arborn last night. This mission has so many things that can go wrong. It's almost inevitable that something will.
That's the fun part. The improvisation, I smiled, humorlessly. How are you feeling? I asked. Never a question a pregnant woman isn't willing to answer. She rolled her eyes as if on cue.
When next I see Trigg Allmother, we're going to have a long talk about the inconvenience of gestation. If she couldn't figure out any better way to get babies into this world...
Not well, I take it.
Oh, all three of them are as healthy as I could ask, Pentandra admitted. I'm getting scryed thrice a week now. No problem with the girls. I just wish they'd stop mistaking my bladder for a quintain. I swear, every time I have to stand up, I have to pee. Every time I sit down, I have to stand up. Sleep? Arborn's lucky he's in the wilderness, blissfully slumbering on wet grass and hard rocks. He knows not the meaning of discomfort.
None of this was new to me. I'd enjoyed 2 and a 3rd pregnancies with Alia and suffered through a sister and a sister-in-law both being pregnant at the same time. But every first-time mother experiences the phenomenally uncomfortable miracle of life as a mystery. No matter her preparation,
It must be experienced and shared before it becomes real to her. It will be over before you know it, I assured her kindly. You still have weeks before you are due. Plenty of time to get this mission underway.
The mission?
She asked, horrified.
Do you think I'm worried about the mission? The mission is a distraction from this, Min,
she said, indicating her giant tummy.
It gives me something else to think about, when I can think at all. My memory is gone,
she admitted. If it wasn't for Everkeen, Allura, and my ministry staff, I'd never get anything done anymore.
I delegated a lot of my preparation to my staff after I sketched out the basic policy. I find myself thinking more about the nursery than the mission. Is that awful?
She asked, her eyes pleading. Oh, dear goddess. Another one. A cynical part of my mind shrieked. No, not at all, I soothed. Look, you're incredibly busy and pregnant besides. Arborn is gone much of the time. You have to prepare for the baby on your own. It's only natural that you think more and more about such things as your time draws near. I'd said essentially the same thing to Alia on at least two separate occasions. As long as the work is done, it doesn't matter who actually did it.
But I'm a professional woman, Min,
she said, much calmer than Dara had been, but no less laden with emotion.
I should be able to devote my fullest attention to the task at hand and not be distracted every time a fight breaks out in my uterus. But it's exhausting, she complained. Just walking across the room is brutal. Stairs? I'm starting to use magic to help me get up a flight of stairs. Do you know how decrepit that makes me feel?
She demanded. I did what I could to calm her down, without seeming like I was trying to calm her down, which would have excited her far more. Thankfully, Pentandra was a little more self-aware and mature in her emotional expressions. That was good. She had enough magical power around her neck to sink a fleet. Imperial magic may have its shortcomings, but learning how to shepherd your emotions is decidedly a strong point. Finally, she heaved a big sigh.
Thank you,
she said, her vulnerability showing. I think I have to have a bloody snip like that every now and again, or I'll go mad.
I spoke with His Grace after the Large Council. After consulting his staff, mostly Salgo and myself, he wants to schedule the campaign for 4 days hence. The mission will proceed 2 days following. Unless you have a compelling reason not to,
she added, searchingly. Self-preservation?
Of course, that will be fine, I answered instead. We meet at Timberwatch? That's the staging ground for both operations, she agreed. We have 3 different waypoints set up there to handle the traffic. Dara has her Al-Shari muse there now. 2 entire wings, ready for battle. Most of the mundane troops there have already been quietly deployed up the road and will be in position within a day or two. As soon as we have final approval, we'll inform the Peel Towers and the other outposts.
Who are you waiting approval from? I asked, confused.
The spellmonger,
she answered dryly. The one who organized this mama's play?
Oh, well, consider it approved, I said, wiping my hands on my tunic.
They were sweaty for some reason. Probably because I'd just set in motion a new war against the Gavanni and their undead masters. People were going to die now because of my words. I might be one of them. That sort of thing can lead to sweaty palms.
Very well,
she nodded firmly. She closed her eyes and then opened them again.
It is done. We attack in 4 days,
she pronounced. To be honest, the waiting is starting to get boring, I grumbled. That earned me a sour look as she pushed her belly at me.
Do you really want to have a conversation about patience with a gestating woman?
She demanded. No, I did not. I made my apologies and my escape. I had had enough of femininity for the day. Alas, it was not done with me. When I returned home to Sevendor Castle, thinking I was safe, I found Sister Bemia, of all people, waiting for me in my tower, drinking wine. She wasn't drunk, but she was headed down that river from the level on the bottle. Is there something I can help you with, Sister?
I just needed a place to retreat and reflect. Someplace private,
she admitted, taking another sip.
You weren't using the place, though. Well, I do that occasionally,
she said sheepishly.
If I linger in my quarters or the chapel, people can find me. And sometimes a priestess doesn't want to be found.
I understand, I nodded, hanging up my cloak on a peg by the door. I grabbed a goblet from the shelf and poured a glass for myself.
I started to relax. She didn't seem to need anything from me. I flopped down on the cushioned chair next to the bookcase. I recalled when this was once my bedroom. Mine and Alia's bedroom, where Manalion was born.
"You know that selling that bloody mountain has caused a stir, don't you?"
she asked casually. "And their Highness's visit? And that bloody divine visitation?" the middle-aged nun asked, her voice rising in pitch every time she added a trial.
"Trigg herself was standing on our commons, the very real, very divine goddess of motherhood, her bloody self,"
she groaned. I sipped a generous amount before I answered. "I would think that the clergy would welcome such a blessing," I ventured.
"You'd think the nobility would have learned a thing or two after having one divine manifestation in his domain,"
she frowned.
"Now we've had 7, and the Everfire.
Somehow I don't think we're going to be flooded with pilgrims of Sisu," I chuckled.
"Trigg is enough," she snarled. "Now I've got to write up the entire thing and submit it to the Abbey at Holy Hill, where they'll send it to the Mother Temple in Sandaria Town, and likely thence to Castor Briel,"
she said, disgusted. "If that's a problem, I can hire—"
"Oh, I've already completed it," she dismissed. "Temple doctrine is to record such a visitation before the next sunrise, to ensure an accurate account. Took me 2 bottles of wine, but I've completed the bloody scroll. It's what comes next that's a bother. The Mother Temple sends an investigator to interview everyone on Kalador about what they saw. That's to keep every villain from claiming Huin took a dump in their privy," she added sourly. "Then they have to verify it with the clergywoman who wrote the account to ensure she's not lying. Death penalty for that. And confirm with the local lord. That's you. And you don't exactly have a sterling reputation for clarity."
"I think you could get the princess to give her testament," I suggested. "She outranks me, and her integrity is beyond fault."
"That's a thought,"
Bemia sighed, considering it.
"She's the one who's funding the new shrine. But the Mother Temple won't authorize me to admit that it's a true divine visitation, worthy of special consideration, until all the bloody parchment is filled out."
"You have my sympathies," I said, raising my glass in salute to her. "I just authorized a bloody war of liberation in the Wilderlands, and a secret raid on the lair of the necromancer. Probably tipped the kingdom over into an age of bloody chaos." She made a sour face.
"I'd hate to see the paperwork on that."
"Let's hope I'm around afterward to do it," I replied gloomily. "I'm doing all of this out of a sense of hope, but I can't help thinking I'm responsible for a lot of needless bloodshed." The priestess chuckled, not the reaction I expected. When Alia had first proposed Sister Bemia as the castle chaplain, I'd agreed mostly because I didn't find her objectionable and Alia wanted it. But I could see how shrewd my wife had been in her inclusion into our household. Bemia understood the human condition as well as any clergy I'd spoken to, and better than a couple of gods I could name.
"Minalyn, you aren't that important," she laughed.
"Oh, you are. Probably the most important man alive right now. But in terms of the tapestry of life, you're but one thread. You intertwine with so many others along the course of your life. What you do or don't do is affected by what they do and don't do, true, but as many had an effect on you as you affect others. Bloodshed? Who is to blame for that? You, or the men who made you who you are? Does not the king, the duke, and the bloody goblins? Aye, and the women too. Does not your mother bear the responsibility for bringing you into the world? Does not your wife own some portion of blame for every death? Will your daughter understand the sacrifices you've made for her? Just as you shouldn't shirk from your responsibilities, neither should you unfairly shoulder those which aren't yours to bear," she said, taking a deep sip of her wine. There was a moment of silence between us as I contemplated her words.
"Sorry,"
she said a moment later. "I didn't mean to give you a sermon," she sighed. "Perhaps I needed to hear one," I admitted, "and perhaps you are correct. I'm doubting my actions because I'm taking responsibility for them, but I've also been forced into this position by others. Even the gods have compelled me, or at least guided me. Do they not bear some of the guilt?"
"You're asking me?"
she snorted rudely.
"I don't know. My mandate is for the spiritual health of the castle folk, not the state of the entire universe. Especially not the gods. Ask them, not me," she insisted.
Just don't invite them here, not out in public, she begged. That's just too much drama for an old woman to stand, and far too much paperwork.
Chapter 26 Fethkala. The squat, ugly-looking building we were surveying was impressive in its way. Considering the people who built it were living in caves a decade ago, it was a decent stab at human-style engineering. A long keep, 2 stories tall, was surrounded by a 12-foot wall made of undressed stone. The roof was thatched, not shingled or tiled, making it far easier to catch on fire. There was a wooden gatehouse, a ditch in front of the wall, and guards who walked its length day and night. But there were no crenellations on the wall. There were no fighting decks. There were only 2 crude wooden towers, one at each end of the long bailey, but they overtopped the wall by no more than 20 feet. The gatehouse had a portcullis, but no postern door. It was the only way into or out of Castle Fethkala. It was an adequate basic defensive structure, more advanced than a basic peel tower, but that was about it. Its biggest advantage was its size. It could hold a fairly large garrison in its long, low hall, and it did. But it wasn't designed to protect the 10,000 people in the sprawling camp around it. It was designed to protect the goblins from them. Encircling the rough fortress was a sprawling series of pathetic huts and tarpaulins, under which the Humani slaves huddled at night, when their masters were most active. It spread out for 0.5 mile on each side of the ugly castle, a vast encampment of institutionalized human misery. The smell of rotting offal and unwashed humanity mingled with the odor of decomposing corpses left around the camp as a morale booster. Adding to the aroma beyond that was the rude rail fence and ditch, with a thorny hedge of some foul netavista shrub that bristled with poison thorns. Beyond that were freshly ploughed fields that far exceeded the land the original 3 freeholds had cultivated. The planting was about to begin, it seemed. Sandoval, Mavone, and I watched the hobgoblin guards with mage sight from horseback on a hillock about 0.5 mile away, between the fields and the fence, as the sleepy morning shift came on and the tired night shift went off guard duty. They all bore a Humani-style tabard bearing the vile device of the Lord of Fethkala, a yellow whip on a dark burgundy field. As soon as the retiring Gavani sentries departed, Kasari snipers began to get into position, crawling into hastily built blinds or climbing stealthily into the treetops around the fields. At the proper time, they would ply their great wilderlands bows and cunningly built crossbows, their bowstrings silenced, to clear the walls of sentries. As the sky in the east lightened with the approaching dawn, a thick column of smoke began to rise from the eastern horizon, just as planned. The Gavani had a storage depot there, where all of the seed corn was put up, away from the starving slaves. The Kasari had managed to set it afire with an alchemical device. Not that they couldn't have done it with a couple of dry sticks. Meanwhile, one of our squadrons of rangers, made up to look like escaped slaves, captured a solitary patrolling Gervan, interrogated him and then allowed him to escape, but not before putting the notion in his furry head that the Humani scum were raiding the supplies stored there. He ran 4 miles to report the apparent attack to the nearest large settlement, Fethkala. I watched the anxious Gervan stumble past the sentries just as the smoke began to really billow in the east. At last, Sandoval muttered, I was starting to think he'd deserted. It would have been the wiser choice, if the less dutiful, agreed Mavone. 15 minutes later, a squadron of 8 human horsemen and 12 Gavani fellhound riders deployed to investigate. Their response time is good, Mavone noted. When your seed corn is in danger, it pays to be vigilant, Sandy agreed. Those unfortunates galloped off to certain doom. There were 100 crossbowmen installed in an ambush 2 miles down the road, just before they would arrive at the burning barn. The war mage detailed to them built a cunning series of glyph fields that slowed them just enough in their charge to allow the iron bolts of the 3rd commando-led arbalests to shred the sortie to the last living thing. Less than 10 more minutes passed, the sky growing ever lighter, when another sentry ran into the crude castle to report the slaughter. A few moments later, another squadron of horse cavalry departed. I just love it when they're cooperative with our plans like that. I think they'll send more, Mavone predicted.
If it's a slave uprising, they need to stomp on it quick. They'll send in heavy forces.
Mavone was prescient. Moments later, 300 hobgoblin heavy infantry exited the gate, blowing their short bronze horns belligerently, marching resolutely toward the distant fire. We waited until they were out of sight down the road before we acted.
"I've informed the other squads," Sandy reported to me, since I was nominally in command. "They're ready."
"I took their wards down," Mavone said helpfully as he dismounted. He was always very skillful at that sort of work. "And there are no shamans here, that I can see."
"They're all up at the Goblin King's palace in guns for a conference," Sandy reported as he drew his blackened mage blade and got down on his hands and knees. "Some inspirational speech or ecclesiastic conference or something like that. That was purposefully in the planning," he added.
"Then let's get to work," I said resolutely. "We have a long day ahead of us." First, we engaged war spells of stealthiness, got as close to the gatehouse as possible, and then thickly peppered the entryway with berserker glyphs. Those cause a fundamental shift to your perceptions and judgment, and encourage you to attack pretty much anything your mind perceives as a threat, including the goblin you just had breakfast with. Just beyond that, we filled the section with spells that would encourage severe doubt and anxiety, encouraging whomever stumbled into the glyphs to flee from danger. That was to keep slaves from being easily cowed into helping with the emergency, and convince any Gavani that running out into the thousands of human slaves was a poor idea, and to run back through the berserker field in case they missed any glyphs. The plan was to get the next wave of Gavani to slay as many of themselves as they could, saving us the trouble. We were just finishing up when they helped us test that theory. Not infantry this time. Slave drivers preparing to order their charges to work. A company of 60 goblin overseers, bearing Fethkala's repugnant device, exited the castle to head for the fields and stumbled sleepily into the berserker zone. Within moments, a riot had broken out. The hobgoblins who had just retired from night duty were roused to put them into order, and then they stumbled into it as well. Enough of the smaller goblins got pushed into the fright zone to make it seem like a rout. Screams, war cries, and shouts of terror filled the morning air and roused hundreds of nearby humans from their squalid tents. A crowd began to gather in front of the gatehouse as they watched their masters feud. The entire thing was funny as hell in a bloody sort of way. By the time the sun was scaling the eastern peaks, the roadway was stained with blood and littered with bodies, while terrified goblins whimpered and fought on the landing in front of the gatehouse. I made a silent count against our intelligence reports. There were maybe 100 defenders left in the castle who weren't injured or imprisoned for rioting.
"I think now would be a good time for us to go ahead and ruin the place," Mavone offered, as two enraged hobgoblins charged against 5 cowering Gavani.
"Let me," Sandoval said, drawing his new war wand. It was a multi-purpose tool he'd spent a few days in Sevendor crafting, and he was eager to test it. The hedge at the edge of the camp withered under his magic, and the rail fence crumbled into sawdust as he strode over the narrow ditch toward the gate. Mavone and I followed him, and we were quickly joined by a half-squad of light cavalry troopers from the 3rd Commando when we motioned them forward. They helpfully silenced the 2 sentry goblins guarding the gate and pushed it open. The Kasari snipers began to fire their silent bows against any defenders in their range, adding further chaos to the situation. Sandy looked around at the squalid camp in disgust, and got visibly angrier as he quietly strode up the main path betwixt the castle and the camp. There was a flash, and the gatehouse behind the warring Gavani was suddenly on fire, from its wooden frame to its thinly thatched rooftop. The compound went into another panic, as a deep bronze bell was struck to alert the defenders of the crisis. That seemed to amuse the growing crowd of slaves onlooking. With the overseers late for getting their human slaves out to the fields, there was nothing for them to do but stand around.
"How shall we approach them?" Mavone asked, thumbing toward the crowd of slaves.
"I think we should introduce ourselves," I suggested, nudging my way forward toward the knot of chained human slaves, watching the Gavani try to fight the fire.
"Excuse me," I said loudly from behind a crowd of 100 or so filthy, scrawny humans in rough hempen tunics who were watching the gatehouse burn with a mixture of anxiety and amusement. "I'm Baron Menelin, the spellmonger of Sevendor."
these noble wizards and myself, and a number of our friends, are here to escort you to freedom. I suggest we go soon, however, unless you want to be put to work on a bucket line. Personally, I said, peering at the fire, I think those fellows can handle it without you. It took a few moments for the meaning of my words to sink in to the prisoners. They had just been beaten and starved and tortured for so long that they didn't understand at first. Then Mavone got impatient.
This is a rescue,
he finally bellowed. Everyone start marching east. We'll handle the goblins. Move! The slaves responded better to a direct command than they did persuasive language at this point, I realized. They had become used to being told what to do, and it took a command to motivate them. The group started shambling toward the east, where Sandoval was encouraging them to go. A few desperate souls took to their heels at once, despite their chains, and began heading for the promise of freedom the sunrise offered. Several others ran back to the camps to spread the unbelievable news. While it took a while to convince them that they weren't dreaming, and that a party of wizards and knights had come to rescue them, as soon as they made that realization, they began to move with more alacrity. Not everyone was in favor of them leaving, however. Apparently, the night watchman in charge of keeping an eye on the sleeping slaves was still on duty, headed back to the castle to get a day's sleep. When they saw a bunch of their charges lurching away as a group, they came running to head them off. They stopped as soon as they saw the horses of the third commando raiders who were herding the slaves out of the camp. It was clear that they weren't the castle's human cavalry. I led my war magi toward them, four human trustees, with the foul brand of the soulless on their arms, and three Gavani, armed with clubs, whips, short swords, and bitterly angry expressions.
What is the meaning of this?
Screamed the leader of the guards, a smallish Gervan, who spoke Narasi fluently.
Prisoner transfer,
Sandoval quipped, facing the officious little twerp.
Why wasn't I informed?
The goblin screamed in passable Narasi, squinting in the morning sunshine. His fellows stared at the long line of prisoners walking eastward, looking confused.
I am the senior officer on duty. Why wasn't I informed? This could have happened after my shift was over. Who authorized this? Where are they being transferred to?
He demanded.
To freedom,
Sandoval said, and blew the Gervan's head off with his new war wand. He has a flair for the dramatic. Mavone struck the other two Gavani with a pain spell that caught two of the human guards in its path as well. My contribution disrupted their internal organs until they were puking and shitting blood. I didn't spare the humans. They were soulless. More, they were willing to beat and slay their fellow humans. We didn't need to take them with us. We didn't need to leave them behind to be of use to the dead god, either.
Those swords seem to be going to waste,
Mavone pointed out to a group of passing slaves who were still wondering if the rumor of rescue was real or just a trick. A few eagerly took the weapons of their captors and began to march even faster. Nothing convinces a man of his freedom more than a weapon in his hand.
There will be more defenders as they get organized, Mavone murmured, glancing up at the smoldering gatehouse. We should get in position to defend. The cavalry won't be here for a while yet.
Minilan, what is your status? Came Pentandra's anxious voice, mind to mind. We've neutralized the remaining defenders at Fethkala and are starting to move the captives east, I reported.
Good. That makes 11 out of 11. Initial reports are all positive, but that could change any moment.
Scrying reports from the barn show a small force moving up the western road, about 4 miles out.
Have fun. I've got things to do,
she said, and was gone.
All the attacks have begun, I reported to my men. Mavone is right. We'll have an aggressive response here before everyone can evacuate, according to Pentandra, in addition to those left here.
Have the other sparks meet us here as soon as they finish up, I ordered Sandy. He smiled and complied. It was like old times in Faris, when I was his squad leader during the occupation. I held the third commando captain, who was directing the prisoners, and explained the situation, Sir Loran, and asked for one of his men to fetch out horses before the fight. I was enormously impressed with the Alshari Third Commando. I'd known them when they were the Third Royal Commando, multi-talented mercenaries handpicked by Count Salgo for the defense of Gilmora. They were crack troops then. Now they were professional military men used to working with war magi in tough conditions.
Each of the 300 commandos who'd been assigned to work with us was as equally comfortable on a horse, storming a redoubt, sneaking through the woods, performing as archers, light infantry, heavy infantry, cavalry, sappers, whatever was required of them. Each commando rode a charger or courser and was clad in chainmail hauberks, with thick leather covering their extremities to their knee-high boots. They wore plain, round, short-necked helms, as a rule, unburnished and blackened against detection. Each commando carried a light lance or spear, a round shield, a cavalry sword strapped to his horse, an infantry blade at his hip, and a newly made crossbow of Vermeeren rosewood. Light, powerful, easy to use from horseback, and clearly an early procurement through the nascent magical smuggling ring. Such weapons carry a fiendish penalty for export. Pentandra had quietly admitted to me, mind to mind, that Count Salgo had purchased 3,000 of them from Planus, at a fair price, the product of some of Vermeer's finest craftsmen. They were just part of the bounty Anguin had showered on his new fighting men when they'd arrived. Their trek from hostile Gilmora to the relative political safety of the Wilderlands had shaped them as a unit. So had the lavish gifts the orphan duke had given the orphaned unit. I'd spoken with the commandos at length as we'd ridden to our positions before the raid. They seemed uniformly grateful to Duke Anguin for taking them into service, and were proud to be known as the Elshari, third commando now. After spending 6 months drilling former freeholders and reformed refugees into militia, they seemed especially eager to participate in this mission of liberation. Mavone and Sandy weren't the only war magi on the Fethkala raid. While we were seeing to the main gate, two other teams of three were eliminating the guards on the other side of camp, while the Kasari snipers began to shoot every furry face they saw inside the castle, and the third commando ran pickets on horseback to rouse the entire camp. Along the way, they didn't hesitate to take a shot at any passing Gavani with their swords, or Pegwan, who showed his face on the wall. When the hobgoblin leader of the Bucket Brigade, who'd finally gotten an organized response to the gatehouse fire underway, took an iron bolt to his throat in the middle of a rousing speech, it didn't take long for the Gavani to finally realize they were under attack. That panicked them. They were prepared for a slave insurrection, not a liberating raid in force. Most of the garrison was already deployed against the raid on the depot. The slaves were marching resolutely toward freedom, the strong bearing the weak and injured. With their gatehouse in flames, they couldn't even get out of the castle now to stop the thousands who were waking up for work and discovering a chance for freedom. "I know it's their first native attempt at building a castle," Mavone noted, nodding to the smoldering fortress, "but perhaps they'll learn to install a postern door next time." "Having one entrance and exit does have its drawbacks," Sandoval agreed, as one of the goblins inside, who tried to lower himself down from one of the towers, took an arrow in his back for his trouble. The Kasari were watching. "It's just poor planning," he said, shaking his head sadly. "Perhaps more than two guards at the gate," I added, "but then this is a prison. They relied upon their terror and the threat of execution and the garrison to keep them cowed. They didn't figure on an outside attack." The prisoners were starting to break into a run as they came to the fence and finally recognized an opportunity to escape. Those who were in any condition to run. They all looked half-starved, their eyes wide and blinking blindly in the sun. The rags they wore were filthy and had infected the many welts on their bodies. The chains and coffles around their necks had chafed their skin raw, leaving red and oozing pustules. Their feet were black and blistered. None were shod. Yet they ran when they had the chance. As the new day dawned, they glanced at the burning gatehouse, heard the irate screams of the goblins inside, and then at the war magi and other warriors of the vanguard who were effecting their escape, and they ran for their lives. At least 2,000 or 3,000 had fled beyond the rail fence and thorny hedge by that time, and the entire remaining Gavani administration was in a panic. The scattered guards across the camp were being slain by the rebellious slaves. The burning gatehouse and the sight of the River of Humanity were all some rebellious souls needed to turn on their guards. A few small groups of guards managed to form around the shacks that served as guardhouses, gathering in a huddle against retribution. But wherever one or two of them tried to stop the flood of frightened slaves, used to obedient simpering and cowering compliance, their former prisoners leapt on them as one and beat them to death with rocks, fists, or their own clubs.
Eventually, the goblins within the castle got enough of the fire under control to allow passage of a few dozen goblins and hobgoblins out into the camp. They immediately began attacking the fleeing prisoners with their cast-iron weapons or thick wooden bats. But they met fierce resistance before my men could even get to them. By that time, enough of the guards' weapons were in the hands of the prisoners that they were able to fend off the worst of the sorties, keeping the stream of humanity flowing. A fully armored hobgoblin with helm and glaive is able to deal quite a bit of damage, especially if he stumbled into a berserker glyph. A few did just that, and began carving a bloody swath.
"Are you not going to help us?"
a man with a long shaggy beard and a desperate look in his eye pleaded as he glanced at the bloody melee unfolding. He might have been a wilderlord or a bandit before he was a slave.
"We'll fight, but we don't have nothing but our chains and our fists."
I didn't know what to say, until it occurred to me that I did have something to offer him. Something left on my staff, Pathfinder, from the Long March. I pointed the staff and activated a hoxter. In a moment, 50 plain siege spears spilled out on the ground.
"Defend yourselves,"
I urged, "but keep them moving. I have thousands yet to get on their feet and underway."
"Trig bless you, spellmonger,"
the shaggy man said, his eyes gleeful as he began distributing the spears. They were the most basic of weapons, a simple wrought iron head, 6 inches long, 3 wide, attached to a stout and reasonably straight ash rod, 6 feet long. The sort of weapon you hand to a man who is fighting for his life in a siege and may not have held more than a hoe in his hand before. Nearly anyone can use a spear to basic effect. Many of these men had used them before, and they were eagerly taken by the angry, frightened prisoners. 50 spears, suddenly deployed, was a surprise to the Gavani and hobgoblins who were trying to stem the flow. The slaves weren't disciplined or well led, but it didn't take much resistance to convince the Gavani to proceed more cautiously, especially when some of the slaves began using their despised chains to entangle the heads of their glaives and swords while their fellows stabbed or pummeled them to death.
"Keep them at bay,"
I ordered Mavone, nodding toward the Gavani from the castle,
"and you keep them moving,"
I instructed Sandy, as I indicated the swiftly flowing river of unwashed humanity. "I'm headed toward the center to fetch the rest of the sparks."
"Aye, Captain,"
Mavone smiled, recalling other days as a commando brought us our horses.
"We'll have it well in hand."
I saluted before riding off toward the far end of the camp with 2 troopers escorting me. I did my best to encourage the slaves to move quickly, but there were plenty for whom such a command was impossible. I urged the strong to help the weak, freed some poor wretches who'd been confined to a gibbet for some offence, and otherwise did what I could to convince the slaves to run. We came upon a tall, rickety shed that several guards and trustees had taken refuge within against the anger of the prisoners. They were shooting arrows and throwing rocks from the summit, screaming out the vile punishments that would be due for any human who did not immediately return to their bed. No one seemed to be listening to them, but they were causing as much harassing damage as possible. I was about to deal with the guards when the entire tower collapsed suddenly. Before I could react, a large figure leapt atop the wreckage of the building and began flamboyantly plying his mage blade against the survivors while he kept up a booming soliloquy about how fearless and deadly he was.
"Are you quite done, Caswallon?"
I asked when the last guard breathed his last breath.
"Now that these vile vermin are dead, spellmonger,"
the big war mage agreed, with a satisfied nod of his head.
"We have split the fetters of hundreds this morn,"
he reported with unnecessary drama in his voice.
"The blood of their captors stains this once fertile land,"
he added, as if I was unaware.
"It has seen the vengeance of Caswallon's blade this day, and the fox's bite earns the debt of 1,000 liberations. What happy sunrise to dawn on the freedom of so many in suffering. I glory in the favor of the gods as we do this noble deed."
I didn't even roll my eyes. Caswallon is just like that. You meet a lot of characters in war magic. A profession that depends upon a practitioner's reputation for power encourages flamboyance and displays of potency to attract clients. Not everyone is good at it. Carmella, for instance, is lousy at presenting herself in such a light, and suffered financially for that for years, until Beauval Vale. Others are quite good. Sarakim had made his career on his flashy style and his incredible displays of archery, and Azar cultivated the idea that he was death incarnate,
since he'd entered the trade. But Caswallon was in a class by himself when it came to his professional presentation. His 6'6" height, broad shoulders, and always bare, muscular arms, he favoured a Parisian wraparound waistcoat sort of garment, specifically to display his biceps under his fighting harness, made him physically imposing. Add to that a thick, long mane of auburn hair that hung to the middle of his back, with the tips bleached white, held away from his eyes by a steel circlet engraved with his symbol, a stylized fox's head, and you can imagine just how visually impressive the War Mage was. But that was just half the show. Caswallon had a penchant for speaking of himself in the third person, stating the obvious as if no one else could see it, and aggrandizing himself with every verbal opportunity. He basked in the glory of battle and prided himself on the righteousness of his cause, regardless of what that might be. Caswallon's personality filled a room, even if there wasn't room for it, and managed to inject itself into nearly every conversation. I suspected that part of his regira had manifested as a sportish talent for charisma, but there was no way to be certain of that without a deep survey of him, and that would be rude. I admit Caswallon's attitude and personality flirted with the frontier of boorishness, no uncommon trait amongst our colleagues. But if his narcissism contended with his charisma, they were both tempered by his bravery and his skills on the battlefield. Unlike many who brag about their power and ability, Caswallon was fearless in his willingness to prove he was every bit as good as he said he was. He was also just a genuinely friendly guy, someone who wanted to be everyone's best friend, as self-serving as that was. It was hard to dismiss the man as an asshole, because he actually believed the stuff that flew out of his mouth. When you're put in command of a spark like that, you have two choices. Try to put him in his place as your subordinate, or encourage his ego with flattery and inspire him to do crazy stuff on your behalf. I'm lazy. I took the latter route. "Then I bear good news, Caswallon," I said, bowing from horseback. "A small Gavani force is bearing down on us, but 2 miles up the western road. While they are not enough to deter this grand liberation, they could serve to harass the hindmost and imperil the freedom of the weakest and most infirm among the prisoners. Could you and your squad lead an ambush of them as they arrive? I can think of no more fitting greeting than to have the fox and his friends challenge them." He was instantly hooked. His eyes narrowed, his brows furrowed, his nostrils flared, and his posture changed subconsciously to a fighting stance. "My friend Minolan, I shall give them such a greeting. They shall drink a stirrup cup of my wrath and taste the bitter bread of my fury. They shall rue the day they took service to their foul master and ever dared emerge from their stinking mountain dens. To the fox!" he called out into the steadily emptying camp. The other two war magi and his team looked up, one eager, one sour. "We have a mission most pressing, my friends. All those who wish vengeance on your captors, follow me, for I will give them battle and see them perish in terror. Any man who stands with Caswallon, the fox, this day shall see the meaning of fury. To the fox! To the fox!" See why I fed his ego? It was voracious. But it also fueled his resolve. As his two comrades came jogging up to him, a small but growing crowd of slaves emerged from the crowd in response to his call. The vast majority of hemp-clad humans had the bloody good sense to flee as far and as fast as they could. But out of every 100 men there is one for whom valor or hatred compelled to take up arms, even in impossible circumstances. Surrounded by thousands, Caswallon's call lured each of those to the War Mage's side until he had half a company. "Pick through the wreckage, my friends, and arm yourselves as best you can," he said, pulling a nasty-looking iron knife out of the dead hand of a crushed Gavani overseer and handing it to a dazed-looking man with a recently broken nose. Tentatively at first, then with more energy, the slaves began to root through the ruined tower and recover whatever weapons they could salvage. They didn't hesitate to use the beams and posts as clubs, or take out bricks if they could find nothing better. In a few moments, Caswallon had recruited an army of 100 enthusiastic slaves to his side. "Take their tools of destruction and turn them on their masters. Arm yourselves and follow the fox and his friends into victory." Damned if he didn't get them to cheer.
Caswallon was just like that. They could all be dead in an hour, but none of them were even thinking about that. I rode back to the now-burning castle with a feeling of satisfaction. The camp was half empty now. The gibbets were cleared, the guard shacks all but destroyed. Mavone and Sandy had reduced Fethkala to ruins. By the time more than a band of goblins could be raised to respond to the raid, we'd be long gone, leaving Fethkala plundered of its most precious resource. Turning Caswallon loose on them, that was just a bonus. Chapter 27 The Gathering of Forces.
That was refreshing, Sandoval yawned, as we finally returned through the ways to the staging area at Timberwatch.
Refreshing? That was bloody well done, Count Salgo greeted us. 11 raids, only one ending poorly. We slew thousands and saved over 100,000, the old soldier read from a dispatch scroll upon which he was keeping a tally. And we knocked their organization and supply chain into Sharul's chamber pot.
How many lost on our side?
361, he called out, thus far, not counting slaves. There are still battles underway. Nearly 200 of those were at Glandon, he added with a sigh. Glandon had been the one dark spot of our otherwise triumphant mission. Glandon had once been a prosperous Wilderlands barony, but had fallen early in the war. Castle Glandon was now deep in the penumbra and commanded by the Gavanni. Instead of being used to protect the human subjects of the barony, as intended, the castle was used to enslave them. The modest armories and smithies there had been augmented by hundreds of temporary forges. They used the high-quality ore they forced the human slaves to dig out of the nearby mines with their bare hands to cast thousands of vicious blades, helms, and other tools of warfare. It was one of several of the Gavanni's manufactories, but by far the largest using human labor. The attack on Glandon, led by the Iron Band, was as much of a surprise attack as the other 10 sorties. But Glandon Castle was more organized than the other human slave depots and designed for defense. A low-scale shaman was still on duty there, for one thing, and half a legion had come in unexpectedly, seeking to be re-equipped with newly forged gear. But all of that could have been dealt with. The Iron Band had sent their best against Castle Glandon, including a dozen war magi with 4 witch stones among them. While the Iron Band troops themselves were not the best for such duties, they were decent common soldiers who had deep experience with goblin fighting. What they did not plan for was the presence not just of an Emmervort, who seemed to be overseeing some special project, but a group of a half-dozen iron folk. Unlike the 3 we had rescued, these were volunteers in their Dark Master's service, or vassals, or both, but they were heavily armored and armed with steel hammers. When the Iron Band met the iron folk at the gates of the castle, the Alon Dradrian proved why they were so feared by the Karshak. In 20 minutes of ferocious battle, they slaughtered over 100 Iron Band's men and 12 third commandos. The Nemavort mostly just watched. Their sacrifice was not in vain. They did preoccupy the Gavanni enough to allow most of the slaves to flee, but it was a grievous blow to lose so many brave and competent men. Eventually, a company of Megalini knights reinforced the mission, protecting the escapees as best they could. They approached as the last dregs of humanity were drained from Glandon's cup of horrors. Their sudden assault, led by Bendanol the outlaw, drove the Dradrian and the Nemavort inside, and kept the disastrous attack from becoming a rout. But it was a fell day for the Iron Band, and one they did not soon forget. Apart from that, as Salgo reported, the effort had proven incredibly fruitful. A flood of slaves was being escorted across the great rivers of the Wilderlands and into the protected eastern quarter, behind the line of castles, peel towers, and military installations set up for the task. The Wilderlords, the third commando, the Iron Bandsmen, and the Mage Lords were escorting them to liberation, hope, and the chance at a future beyond a goblin's lunch. They were being met with a huge feast, comparatively speaking. Anguin, actually Pentandra under Anguin's authority, had contrived to have hot food waiting in abundance for the starving prisoners, and thousands sought the attention of the priests and barbers who'd been called in to tend their wounds. Nor had the raids been limited to liberation.
Dozens of companies set out with specific missions of destruction designed to ruin the fishing net of support and manufacture the goblins had developed out of the penumbra. Individual human lords who had sought peace with the Gavanni through subservience, going as far as to swear fealty as vassals to the goblin king and his dark master, were singled out for violent retribution. Cantons where horrific magical experiments were being conducted were wiped out, their abominable creations slain alongside their sadistic creators. Strategic targets throughout the penumbra were sacked and destroyed. The suddenness and surprise of the early spring attack devastated the leading edge of the penumbra, leaving the interior largely unprotected from a concerted assault. Indeed, after securing the prisoners he'd been assigned beyond the banks of a river, Azar turned his two companies of heavy cavalry and stormed toward the undefended heart of goblin territory, burning and killing as they went. They joined up with Bendanol's company and recruited some Wilderlords who were still in the fight, and drove toward the western territories until they met significant resistance. They made every pretense of heading toward Gans, where the goblin king waited. Then they retreated, doing even more damage in their withdrawal than they did in their advance. The feint was strong enough and close enough to the goblins' new civil heartland to be instructive. Sherul might rule the Umbra, but his command over the outskirts was in doubt. The goblins' core was in peril, we'd told them. One good push against their center with enough troops, and we'd be retaking the Dark Vale before the end of the year. None of that was really true, of course. It would take more than 3 companies of heavy infantry to win the war, far more. But Azar and Bendanol devastated enough land between the Dark Vale and Tudri to force the Gavanni to bring their defenses closer in. They were no longer looking forward to an invasion, with their staging area in such disarray. At least that was our intention. If we could force Shudul's surrogates into a defensive posture, we'd be able to launch our attack at Ulam Seheri without fear of reprisals against the Wilderlands. We'd lightened their sacrificial arsenal and their workforce by over 100,000 souls, with more arriving all the time. Without the bulk of their human slaves as hostages and fodder, the penumbra was all but defenseless. Indeed, as the region descended again into chaos, smaller farms and holdings rebelled against their Gavanni masters and fled, often setting the places ablaze before they retreated into the east. It was a successful mission on all accounts, though a huge swath of humanity now found themselves penniless, stranded in the Wilderlands, and still torn from their families and their lives, they were alive, no longer destined for the sacrificial stone. As warm-ups go, it was one of my better ones.
"We're still waiting for our teams to filter in, particularly the gate crushers," Pentandra reported over the long trestle table in the barn of Timberwatch. There was a perfectly good hall that had been built on the site, adequate for our needs, but we'd naturally congregated in the big blue barn when we'd arrived at Timberwatch. I guess the place brought back memories of simpler times and the excitement of the original, terrifying battle. It just seemed natural to return.
"Most of them are trickling back from the mopping-up operations. We're bringing them through the ways as they return to the Peel Towers.